A very wealthy Texan had a daughter of marriageable age, and he determined to have a coming out party for her. This simply meant that he was going to invite all of the eligible bachelors in the area over to his house so he could get a good look at them. You people in sales would call that group prospecting. His reason was obvious. He wanted the very best for his daughter. So when all of the eligible young men arrived from a 100-mile radius around his 200,000-acre farms, stocked with numerous cattle and producing oil wells, he called them all out to go down to his Olympic-sized swimming pool, which he had the foresight, amazingly, to stock with a number of deadly water moccasins and alligators. He told the young men that the first one who jumped into the pool and swam the length would be given three choices. The first choice was $1 million in cash. The second choice was 10,000 acres of his prime ranch property with oil wells and cattle. And finally, the third choice would be the hand of his beautiful daughter in marriage. And he was quick to point out that she was his only heir, and that after he and his wife passed on, she would inherit this entire spread along with her husband. No sooner were those words spoken than there was a large splash at the other end of the pool, and in virtually no time at all, another splash at the opposite end as a young man got out of the pool dripping wet. He had set a world's record that would never be surpassed, much less equaled, for swimming the length of that pool. As the crowd of young men and the father, very excited, rushed down to congratulate him, he stood there in eager anticipation. "Well, son, you've got your choice. What do you want? The $1 million in cash?" "No, sir." "Do you want the 10,000 acres of my best ranch land?" "No, sir." "Then I guess you must want the hand of my beautiful daughter in marriage." "No, sir." By this time, he was somewhat frustrated and perplexed. So he demanded, "Well, what, son, do you want?" He said, "I want to know the name of the man that pushed me into the pool." Well, I think it goes without saying that all fathers want the best for their daughters, and mothers as well, and sons, fathers and sons, whether they're of modest means or whether they're wealthy. God certainly feels that way about us. He feels the same way about all of his children, which is quite evident in the multiple examples we have throughout the Bible. At times, he is strict and disciplines us. At other times, he's lenient and very merciful. You know, when our children are infants, we're pretty much in control of their lives. They don't have a lot to say. They don't have a lot of direction that they can give us because we pretty well provide for them. We take care of them. You know, but as the years go by, and especially as they grow into their teens and get toward the upper part of their teens, things begin to change. You know, at some point, the chances are very good after graduate from high school. Maybe they'll go off to college. Or, in some cases, some people go into the service or will take a job in another town so that they will be leaving home and living on their own for the first time. You know, when that happens, our relationship with our children will begin to change. And the question we may ask ourselves at that point in time is, what kind of a relationship will we have with them at that point? You know, what kind of a relationship do we have with them now? Or, in some cases, what kind of relationship, you know, do we not have? What kind of relationship would we like to have? Well, let's look at some biblical examples to use to help us cement our relationships, you know, so they'll continue to honor us, not only on Mother's Day, not only on Father's Day, not only on Grandparents' Day, but on every day during every part of every year. And while this is directed toward parents and grandparents, for the most part, the principles can be certainly applied to all of our relationships. Turn to Deuteronomy 4, beginning in verse 9. Deuteronomy 4, verse 9. Only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes have seen, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life. And now here's a specific instruction that is given to the children of Israel who have gone through all kinds of obstacles, been in bondage for a number of years, and you know the history, so I don't have to repeat it, of all the things they went through before they reached this point. And God tells them, but teach them thy sons and thy son's sons. So you're not only responsible for teaching your children, but your grandchildren as well, and great-grandchildren if you're around at that time. Teach them thy sons and thy son's sons. Deuteronomy 8, verse 7, there's another verse, kind of a additional emphasis on this particular point. Deuteronomy 8, verse 7. And thou shalt teach them diligently. Diligently, not casually, not haphazardly. You shall teach them diligently unto thy children and grandchildren, and shall talk of them when thou sittest in thy house. So when you're sitting around in the evening at dinner, you take the opportunity to talk to them about what's going on in their life, what they've been doing at school, you know, how their classes are going. Are they having particular problems with any class? What are their friends doing? What kind of problems are they having? You sit down when they're at home and you go over things like this. When you walk us by the way, you know, maybe you go out for a walk after dinner and that you take them with you and you talk to them. It's a constant process. When you lie down, if you're lying down, especially little ones, you're teaching them to pray before they go to bed at night. And when you rise up the the next morning. So aside from the fact that you have to spend time sleeping, the rest of the time is a 24/7 process. You're communicating throughout every day to your children and your grandchildren. Okay, so we know that's pretty clear, that's pretty straightforward. There's shouldn't be any question about that in our minds. We teach them, but it goes way beyond that. Do we listen? Question mark. You know, the dialogue can be directed at them, but do we listen to what they have to say? It needs to go both ways. It's not just one-sided. Here, you do this. This is what the Bible says. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. It shouldn't be one-sided. You have to listen to what they say. You have to listen to the questions they have, the concerns they have, the explanations they would like to receive. Do we spend quality time with our children? You know, a little boy was studying his geography lesson, and he asked his father, "Dad, where are the Alps?" "How should I know? Go ask your mother where she put them." I'm not talking about that kind of time where the father wasn't paying any attention at all. He was only half listening. Maybe he didn't know where the Alps were. I don't know. Maybe he didn't even know where Switzerland was. But that's not the example I'm talking about. That is not quality time, and I certainly don't mean like that. When our children ask us a question, we need to stop whatever we're doing, and we need to listen intently and not just half-heartedly to what they ask us. That's how they learn. That's where they get the information. Wouldn't you rather have it come from your mouth than from someone else who might not have the interest in them? You know, the drug dealer who's looking to find a new customer. And believe me, that reaches into the, you know, when they're quite young now, they get involved or confronted with that type of thing. They want to know that we're keenly interested in what they are doing. You know, this is especially important if a question mark comes up about the marks on the report cards when that time rolls around every school year. You know, they want us to know, and in some cases, maybe they'd prefer us not to know if they got that D on a test in geometry that's reflected in their report card. Revelation 20, verse 2. Revelation 20, verse 2. There comes a time when John says, "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works." The books being the books of the Bible. Now, we know that our salvation is a gift. It's given to us freely. But over and above that, what are your expectations about the kingdom of God and what you'll be doing for the rest of eternity? Now, maybe that's a question that, well, that's a little too far-fetched for me to think about, you know. I just want to be there. I think we all want to be there. But what do we intend to be doing during eternity? You know, What have we done during this life? What are we good at? What is our background? We're going to be judged, and also in that process, God will be reviewing our report card based on what we've done, and if we've had the blessing of children, the blessing of rearing our own children, he'll be reviewing how we taught them, how we treated them, how we loved them, how much time we spent with them. Our children need to know that they have our undivided attention, that we actually hear what they're saying, not that we just nod their heads and go on reading our paper, only half listening. They need to know that you actually hear and that you're responding to what they have to say, that we're there not only physically, but even more importantly, emotionally as well. I can remember when my son was a freshman in college, I got a letter one day from him. It was on yellow paper, very small lines, 5 pages printed on either side, each side completely filled. And he was telling me about a girl that he'd met and how much he was interested in her and all of these things. I never had this kind of conversation with him before. When I saw the letter, I thought, oh boy, he's really in trouble, without reading it. But he just wanted my advice, you know, his first love. He wanted, you know, to get my take on it. Well, that caught my attention, the 5 pages, because he never ever wrote anything like that before. Maybe a card, but nothing like that. Your children want to know that you're not just paying lip service to what they're trying to tell you or what they're trying to ask us. I include myself in that. You know, it seems grandparents always have time for their grandchildren. I don't remember it verbatim or exactly, but one time I saw a bumper sticker that said something to the effect, if I would have known how much fun my grandchildren would be, I would have had them first. You know, when you think about it, I think one of the reasons for that is that we don't have them 24/7. A couple of days and you can hand them back to their parents. So that may be part of why having grandchildren is so much fun. Do we spend quality time with our children? You know, not waiting for the grandchildren to roll around, spending time with our children. Do we allow our children the safety of having their own feelings? You know, that's a question I think that deserves an answer. And we're the only ones that can answer that. And if we were asked, would we be satisfied with what our answer would be? Do we allow our children to own their own feelings? You know, our children and our spouses, for that matter, shouldn't be carbon copies of us. Turn to Proverbs 14, verse 10. Proverbs 14, verse 10. And I'm reading this from the NLT, the New Living Translation. Each heart knows its own bitterness, and no one else can fully share its joy. I don't know, even as close as I am to some of you, how bitter you may be today, much less how joyful you may be. You know, only you yourself have that capacity and that ability. No one else can know that. Each heart knows its own bitterness, and no one else can fully share its joy. It would be nice if that was possible, but it's not. You cannot know what someone else is feeling. You can try. If you've experienced a death, for example, in your family, if you've experienced a divorce, and you talk to someone that's perhaps suffering from the pains of loss, you can begin to understand, but you don't know in their own individual case because of all the factors relevant to whatever the situation is. You don't really know. We shouldn't insist that our children have the same feelings we do. A lady once told me about her mother, who had the habit of talking down to her, not only when she was little, but also as an adult. And she said, you know, if I'm around her long enough and she does that long enough, pretty soon I'm acting like a baby. I'm responding to what she's saying to me. I'm reverting back to what I was like as a child. And, you know, that was based on her response to her mother's actions. And she told me it was the strangest feeling. In Ephesians 6, verse 4, Ephesians 6, verse 4, and you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You don't want to provoke your children. You don't want to make them angry and upset with you. We're supposed to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If we try to force our feelings on our children, or anyone else for that matter, it'll eventually backfire and make them irritated and angry. You know, we teach them, we set the right example ourselves, but we shouldn't provoke anger, which can lead to resentment on their part. We need to understand that our actions will affect our children way beyond their childhood. You know, they're unique individuals and they need to be treated as such and recognized for their own individuality. Not put down because their thoughts don't exactly mirror ours. We are their shepherds. You know, we're responsible for giving them the right examples, guiding them in the right way, but the reality is they will make the final decision when it comes to choosing which direction their life takes as they move forward. But you've got to take a hand in guiding them as they're growing up. That's not a responsibility you can shirk. Proverbs 27, verse 19. Proverbs 27, verse 19, and this again from the NLT. As a face is reflected in water, so the heart reflects the real person. When you look into a pool or you look into down into a lake that's not being affected by the ripples of wind or anything like that, and it's very placid, you can see your own reflection much in the same way as you see it in looking in a mirror. Well, your heart reflects what's going on in your life, and I'm not talking about this thing that's beating so many beats every minute. The heart being the mind, the thought, the soul, what's going on up here, what's causing you to do what you do, what's causing you to react to what you're reacting to. Your heart reflects the real person. You know, you've heard, some of you probably, maybe you're older, you've heard the George and Ira Gershwin song, "Let's Call the Whole Thing Off." You like tomatoes and I like tomatoes. Tomatoes, tomatoes. You know, everyone has different likes. There, in that song, they're looking at class distinctions. You know, the highbrows and the lowbrows. But that can refer to just about anything in life that affects your thinking and your likes and the things that are important to you. You're not going to find someone else that thinks completely the same way as you do. You know, we need to recognize these differences in our children and appreciate them and help them to expand them. You know, not squelch them or put them down because they don't think, look, or view things in the same way we do. We need to develop empathy with them. You know, it's great to have someone who understands us. That's what empathy is, and that is what our children need to feel they're receiving from us. You know, it's a major step in helping them understand what is important and in helping to cement all of the relationships they'll have with other people in their lives as they go on through life. If they can have empathy with and from their parents, it's far easier to have it with other people as well. We need to realize our children's growth is unique. You know, sometimes we try to force children or we try to push them to do something that they don't really want to do or be, for that matter. You know, if we do, we're pushing against their very nature. Pushing them to do or be something that just isn't there. Just because we like it doesn't mean they do or will. We should encourage them and give them room to grow, but we should not push them. Take an interest in what they are interested in and help to expose them to what it is, what it's like by taking them to visit a place where the activity takes place so they can look at it and see it firsthand. I wouldn't have been able to work on the railroad as a fireman while I was going through college if my dad hadn't taken me to the roundhouse in Skycomish when I was growing up, where he worked and given me the chance to be around steam engines, the electric engines that pulled the cars through the Cascade Tunnel before they built the blower on the other end so that diesels could go through. But being around that environment, and he wasn't trying to do it to generate interest, I don't think. He just wanted me to see what he did. And I really appreciated it. And later on, it paid dividends because I was able to go part of the way through college, at least, with the income that I earned during the summer. In 1 Samuel 1, and I'm going to paraphrase much of the story, but you can turn there because we will be looking at a few verses. In 1 Samuel 1, there was a man named Elkanah who had two wives. One of his wives was barren, because the Lord had shut up her womb, we're told. And you don't have to turn there, but in Psalm 113, verse 9, We're told, "He maketh the barren woman to keep house and to be a joyful mother of children." So, not, I don't know if Hannah was aware of that. And she was very distraught. And she wanted a child, and the other wife had children, and that upset her, of course. So she prayed and vowed a vow and said, if you give me a son, then I will give him unto you for life. And Eli, who was a priest at that time, said, saw her lips moving, but couldn't hear a voice. So he thought she was drunk and reprimanded her to stop drinking. And she said she hadn't been drinking, but was sorrowful and had poured out her heart before God. So Eli told her that her prayer had been heard and that her petition would be granted. So she went back home. She became pregnant and had a son named Samuel. And when she had weaned him, and the commentaries are kind of all over the board on what age a child at that point would have been weaned. Some said 2 or 3 years. Some said as many as 5 or 6. Whenever she weaned him, she took the child to Eli. And picking up the story in 1 Samuel 1, verse 26. And she said, "O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here, praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I ask of him." Verse 28, "Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord." She repaid her vow just as she promised. And that's interesting, the language that she used. She was still his mother. She would still have all of the feelings that any mother would have for a son. But he was on loan to God. Now, if you think about what she did during the time she had him, knowing that it was going to be a very short duration compared to his entire life, and that he was going to be given to God, I imagine she was very careful about what she said, what she did, how she taught him. She wanted to make sure that he was weaned, not only physically, but emotionally, and also was at a point where he could begin to be trained by Eli for service for the Lord. And in the next chapter, 1 Samuel 2, verse 26, "And the child Samuel grew on and was in favor both with the Lord and also with men." So he was well-rounded. He had been trained by her and by Eli and was respected by everyone he came in contact with. I think we'd all like to have our children fit that particular mold. We would like them to be respected. We'd like them to be liked. And that is the kind of boy that he became. You know, she'd done a great job in laying the foundation for him. I read somewhere, and I can't document it, but somewhere that a child's basic core is formulated in the first 6 years of his life. I don't know how accurate that is, but it demonstrates how effective she was, certainly, and how diligent she was in her training and in our teaching. You know, in a way, isn't that what God does with us? Doesn't He lend our children to us to work with them, to train them and bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, as we're told in Ephesians 6, verse 4? He gives us, or lends those children to us for a certain period of time. And what we do with them while we have them is up to us. You know, if we look at the newspaper and bold headlines saying so-and-so was arrested for embezzling X number of dollars, you don't want to see your children's names plastered over the newspaper saying something like that, or it could be any number of things that you see in the news. Just as Samuel grew in favor with God, but also with other men as well, you want your children to replicate that. You know, Jesus repeatedly teaches us in parables and examples in the New Testament how important children are, and how we won't enter the kingdom of God unless we humble ourselves and become like them. He rebuked the disciples for when they tried to prevent the parents bringing little children to have their hands laid on them, and gave us many other examples that help to emphasize and demonstrate the importance of children. In 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, "But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel or an unbeliever." Now, right here in this particular verse, that's used to emphasize that we as parents are responsible for the physical well-being of our children, for providing food and clothing and shelter and the basic necessities of life. That is our responsibility. But it goes far beyond that as well, since it includes all the intangible things that that come with the job of being a parent. You know, a few of which we've touched on here this afternoon. If we really want our children and or our grandchildren to honor us, then over and beyond providing for their physical needs, we need to spend quality time with them. We need to allow them the safety of having their own feelings. We need to have empathy for them. And finally, we need to realize that their search for growth is unique to them. If we do this, they will have been given the right start in this thing we call life, and they will have an excellent roadmap to use in their path to success, both physically, emotionally, but most importantly of all, spiritually, as sons and daughters of God in His kingdom.